This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, we will dabble in housing and electric vehicles and Legos. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 19th of December. Good as it always is to have you along, everybody. All right, to begin, correlation is not, repeat, not causation. That much we know. To continue, though, yeah, sure, Kai, but the data on housing starts today can't just be coincidence, can it? Maybe, maybe not, but it sure is interesting. Said starts, the number of new private residential homes whose construction, you know, started, was up in November. And not just by a little bit either. They surged nearly 15%, pretty much blew expectations out of the water. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour does the compare and contrast, the correlation and causation, if you will, with interest rates, mortgage rates, and our American housing market.
Economists were predicting housing starts would actually fall last month. But no, they exploded. 1,560,000 single-family homes got on their way to being built.
I view this as a positive number, but a little bit of grain of salt.
Chris Derides is deputy chief economist at Moody's Analytics. These numbers are seasonally adjusted, meaning they're kind of corrected to account for seasonal patterns, more activity in the summer, less in the winter.
That's the typical pattern.
And the typical pattern is based on history. Problem is, recent history is a little wacko, what with the pandemic.
We just want to be mindful that the data may not fully reflect the new seasonal patterns that we're observing.
But setting statistical quibbles aside, the trajectory of the housing market is looking not bad. David Miracle is chief U.S. economist at Goldman Sachs.
The broad message is, despite the fact that mortgage rates are much, much higher than they were before the pandemic, the housing sector is held up pretty well so far, despite those higher rates.
When the Fed started raising rates and the vice started to tighten around the housing market, there was already a severe shortage of single-family homes, which has kept home prices from crashing.
And that means that the incentive for home builders to continue building at a quick pace so they can sell at those high prices has still been there.
The incentive is a little less there for the developers building apartment buildings, says Gus Fauché, chief economist at PNC. Multifamily starts were more subdued last month. He says that is because they've already had a rush of construction.
That supply has come online. That has slowed rent growth dramatically. So that's made multifamily construction less feasible.
But again, overall, things are looking good. In the third quarter, housing actually helped grow the economy.
That's the first time that's happened in more than 2 years.
As inflation falls, interest rates fall, and mortgage rates fall, Fauché says you can expect housing will continue to pad the U.S. economy next year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
A brief detour into global trade on the way to Wall Street today, if we might. Shares of two of the world's biggest container shipping companies, that'd be Hapag-Lloyd and Maersk. They were lower today, but they've been having a nice little rally the past couple of days. Threats of attacks by Houthi rebels in the Red Sea have led those carriers and others to steer clear and take the longer route around the Cape of Good Hope. The investing theory you're looking for goes like this. Longer route means they can charge higher rates, which means higher profits. On the eastern seaboard of the United States, the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan, up a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We get, as you know, snapshots of the American labor market from time to time, weekly with what are called first-time claims for unemployment benefits, monthly with the big jobs report, also, but much less discussed, annually with what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls its report on the work experience of the population. Data from 2022 dropped today. Our own Elizabeth Trovall has that story.
Let's travel back to 2022. The year of midterm elections, the easing of COVID-19, Kim K dating comedian Pete Davidson, and
extremely low headline unemployment.
In any given month, the unemployment rate hovered around 3.6%, says the Economic Policy Institute's Heidi Shierholz. But if you look at the whole year,
the unemployment rate was 7.6%. So twice as many people experienced unemployment at some point during the year than, you know, the average monthly unemployment rate in 2022.
That 7.6% is the lowest number in the history of that data, which the government started collecting in 1958. And that historic low came during the Great Resignation.
People were quitting their jobs and in many cases just finding another job without having to face any gap in their paychecks, any gap in time worked.
Workers had more choices, says Erica Groshen with Cornell.
You know, that suggests actually a very efficient labor market, that people were finding good matches.
The labor market has been strong across virtually every demographic, says David Madland with the Center for American Progress.
For women, for men, for young people, for older workers.
And despite some cooling since last year, Harry Holzer with Georgetown University says workers have maintained leverage.
Employers will keep needing some level of compensation growth to hire and retain workers.
Or workers may outright demand it. Ruth Milkman is with the City University of New York.
Workers aren't nearly as fearful that if something goes wrong with their organizing efforts or a strike, that they'll get fired for it.
She says the recent job market has infused new energy into organized labor. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
The work experience of the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report can be a little rough. They're up early, getting you everything you need to know to start your economic day. Well worth it, though. You got to check it out. As happens every January the 1st, as will happen in a couple of weeks, new laws are going to kick into gear, as will certain provisions of some regulations and of some laws that were actually passed a while ago. Our example today, come New Year's Day, some electric vehicles are going to get more expensive. They'll be losing eligibility for tax breaks because they don't have enough parts in them sourced from or assembled in North America. The federal government's trying to pull the supply chains for EVs, their batteries in particular, out of China onto this continent. Tax policy is one incentive. There are also benefits to be had under the Inflation Reduction Act as well. The United States, though, has company in the global, hey, let's build EV infrastructure competition. Battery makers are setting up shop in Canada, too, when the government there is offering its own set of subsidies. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports now from north of the border.
Laurent Terrien and I are trudging along an abandoned road covered in wet snow.
So we are just next to the Richelieu River. It's a peaceful suburb.
We're about a dozen miles from Montreal, on land that used to be home to a plant that closed in the 90s after 120 years of manufacturing chemicals and explosives.
Dynamite, chemicals, airbags,
Trees and reeds have grown up from the remediated soil, but if Tevlian's company completes its plans, in a few years, they'll be replaced by a battery manufacturing plant.
It's a complex of pretty massive buildings because battery manufacturing takes a lot of space.
Tevlian is with Northvolt, a Swedish firm that makes batteries for Volkswagen, Volvo, BMW, and other companies. Northvolt has grown quickly in Europe, and even before the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, passed in the U.S., it was eyeing an expansion to North America.
At first, we didn't very much look into Canada. We were looking at building the plant in the U.S.
But then, Tevlian says, Northvolt got a call from a Canadian economic minister.
What Canada says is we don't have the big pockets the Americans do, but on some specific projects, we can choose to mimic IRA or mirror IRA.
And the cars Northvolt's batteries would go in would still be eligible for that U.S. tax credit. Northvolt ended up with a funding package from the Quebec and Canadian governments worth over $2 billion U.S. dollars, and it could receive billions more once the plant starts producing batteries. Two other factors really swung Northvolt's decision in Quebec's favor, starting with the giant province-owned power utility, Hydro-Québec.
You have to sort of see Hydro-Québec as the, you know, Saudi Aramco of Quebec.
François Bouffard is an associate professor of electrical engineering at McGill University in Montreal. Hydro-Québec was created in the 1940s, and in the 60s, it started building massive dams on the province's rivers.
The advantage of what all these decisions that were made in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s is that now we have, yes, a quasi 100% green power in Quebec, and we've also enjoyed some of the lowest rates.
Hydro-Québec's dams are not without controversy. Their creation flooded indigenous land, but they gave the province abundant renewable power, a major selling point for Northvolt and something provincial economic boosters tout to industry.
We're blessed by our geography.
Jean-François Belland is vice president of Invest Quebec, the government-owned investment bank. In addition to cheap hydropower, the province also has mineral deposits.
We have the lithium, we have the nickel, the copper, essentially the basis, the input of the process.
But critics are worried about the potential environmental impact of the Northvolt plant, while others don't like that billions are going to foreign companies.
It's really hard to prove that these subsidies do have the effect they want to have.
Jean-Philippe Meloche is a professor at the Université de Montréal. He studied past subsidy programs in Quebec, and he thinks the government would have done better to fund local research and development.
What we know is that where we get the better value in economic development is where we have the knowledge and innovation within our industry.
But local supporters say the thousands of jobs expected to be created by the Northvolt plant will boost the local economy for a decade or more. Trudging back across the future Northvolt site, Laurent Terrien with the company is thinking in a shorter time frame.
This is a global run to market, and we want to deliver our first cells out of our first building in July of 26.
In the battery world, he says, that's basically tomorrow. So the company will take all the government support it can get. In Saint-Bassier-le-Grand, Quebec, I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace. Coming up.
If you're interested in artwork, it's the time to buy right now.
You done with your holiday shopping? Because I'm not. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 251 today, 0.6%, 37,557. NASDAQ was up 98 points. That's about 0.6%, 15,003. The S&P 500 found 27 points in the couch cushions. That's about 0.5%. 47.68. We heard from Sabri that the number of privately owned housing starts shot up in November. So, how about some home building and construction stocks? Beazer Homes USA found 5.4%. Timber company UFP Industries grew 3.2%. Affirm is one of the biggest providers of BNPL services. What do you think? BNPL, buy now, pay later. Company stock jumped today after it revealed it would offer those services at Walmart self-checkout kiosks. Affirm Holdings Incorporated racked up 15.4%. Bond prices were up too. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell 3.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's some data out from the World Bank on remittances, money sent home by expat workers around the world. It's data on which countries had the greatest gains in remittances and whence those remittances came. Low and middle income countries saw 4% gains in remittances, give or take. Regionally, countries in Latin America and the Caribbean saw increases of around 8%. Globally, most remittances do come from the United States, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Given all the turmoil of the last few years, a global pandemic, recession, inflation, Dilip Rotha at the World Bank says it's been surprising to see remittances increase as much as they have. They dropped off slightly in 2020, but
since then, in 2021, 2022, remittances have surged
by more than 10% in 2021, 8% in 2022, and now this year, just under 4%. One of the main reasons remittances have grown so much recently is how quickly the labor market and the economy in the U.S. recovered after COVID.
Generally, remittances are actually driven by conditions where the migrant is working.
Pia Arrhenius is at the Dallas Fed.
We saw in a recent study that employment growth in the construction sector explained 2/3 of the increase in remittances to Mexico during the pandemic.
In the last couple of years, Manuel Orozco at the Inter-American Dialogue says rising prices have also driven many people to send more money back home to family in countries where inflation soared.
Migrants have basically, to some extent, helped compensate those realities by sending a little bit more than they usually send.
Remittances don't just help individual families. Dilip Rotha at the World Bank says they also make a huge difference to local economies and to countries. In Tajikistan, remittances make up almost half of GDP. In Samoa, Lebanon, and Nicaragua, it's between a quarter and a third of GDP.
It's incredible how important these small sums of money become when they are added up for a country.
This year, all those small amounts have added up to $669 billion, more than the total amount of foreign direct investment and development assistance combined. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Here's the thing about clean energy. Clean it may well be, cheap it is not. We're talking solar specifically here, and putting panels on your roof can lower your electricity bills, it'll reduce your carbon footprint, and there are some sizable federal tax credits. That is all mostly in the long term. Up front, though, the cost can be significant, which puts home solar out of reach for a whole lot of people. A program down in Georgia is trying to do something about that, as Emily Jones of WABE and Grist reports.
Seth Gunning and Nicole Lee are sizing up a house near Savannah.
Plenty of roof space. Newer roof, newer house. Ideal.
Yeah, so ideal solar for solar. Rating.
Oh, yeah.
They're both solar installers, contractors with the new Georgia Bright solar leasing program. And Lee says this house is perfect.
This is an amazing candidate for solar because it is solar ready. We know they have the newer upgraded electrical system. Plenty of sun because it is a newer neighborhood, so there are no mature trees.
If the homeowner signs on, he won't buy solar panels. He'll lease the system from the national nonprofit that runs the Georgia Bright program, the Capital Good Fund. And Gunning says the savings could be huge.
So just with solar, after his lease payment, he's looking at a savings of about $400 a year.
The Georgia Bright program is for people who earn less than $100,000 a year. Lee says it's especially important to provide solar for those households who usually have to spend a greater share of their income on energy.
This program levels the playing field for those families who are facing those energy burdens to help them reduce their energy costs.
Because installing solar costs a lot up front, those families with the highest energy burden often can't afford it. There's a substantial federal tax credit to offset the cost, but you need a tax liability to claim it. So again, people with less income have often missed out until now. A recent change to federal law allows nonprofits to claim the clean energy tax credit for rooftop solar through a direct refund. Andy Posner is the CEO of Capital Good Fund.
So if it's a $10,000 system and we're going to get a $3,000 refund check from the IRS, it costs us less to purchase the system.
Solar leasing isn't new, but this tax change is. And because of it, Posner says his company can charge less than many for-profit solar installers.
Also because we don't have the same requirements for return on investment as a for-profit.
Savannah homeowner David Morgan bought his 1955 house a couple years ago. He's been wanting to install solar panels, and he says the Georgia Bright program felt like a good fit. Right now, his electricity bill is around $270 a month. He says once his solar panels are installed,
I'll be into the solar panel program for $98 a month, and I should be using between $60 and $70 a month from Georgia Power.
A savings of about $100 a month. Morgan makes $65,000 in the disaster response industry. He says he'll put his solar savings towards retirement.
Every little bit helps towards trying not to work when I'm old.
And he says he's glad he'll be doing his part to fight climate change.
If more folks get on board with trying to go with renewable energy and get away from just things that are really doing more harm than good. And this is one of those programs that anybody can actually get involved in.
The Georgia Bright program is aiming to add solar to around 200 roofs in the Atlanta and Savannah areas in the next few months. After that, the organizers hope to expand. In Port Wentworth, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
With the caveat that you should always and definitely consult your own financial advisor, we do talk a lot about investing on this program. Tangentially, mostly, when we do the numbers or talk about a company's earnings. Stocks, bonds, that kind of thing. Mainstream investments, if you will. But there is a whole wide world out there of more niche places that people put their money. Alternatives to the mainstream. Wine, art, other collectibles. Marketplace's Justin Ho talked to some people dabbling in them back in 2019, and he made some calls the other day to check on their performance since the pandemic. Here you go.
Back in 2010, Nate Tobik was helping his parents move out of their old house. He and his wife were about to have their first kid, so he pulled some of his old Lego sets out of the attic. Over the next few years, Tobik and his family started putting those sets together.
And started to look up missing pieces on eBay and realize, wow, these things are going for a lot of money.
Some of them are going for hundreds of dollars. One set, a Lego train with a crane on it, was going for over $1,000. So Tobik started buying up cheap Lego sets from local garage sales and thrift stores, and he'd sell them online for double what he paid, he says, at minimum. But then the pandemic happened, and a lot of people started selling their old Legos.
I think it was people who were sitting around at home started to look at what they had in the attic, and they said, wow, maybe I could do this too.
People also realized how valuable their Legos were, And as they saw prices go up, they started selling their Legos for more too. Suddenly, Tobik's buy low and sell high investment strategy no longer worked.
We couldn't find anything at a deep enough discount to where we could sell it again and lock in a profit.
The same thing happened with the fantasy card game Magic the Gathering, which has a strong secondary market for individual cards. Seth Robertson has been playing the game for years, and he'd often buy up one or two extra boxes of cards, hoping they'd appreciate in value. And when the pandemic hit, card values skyrocketed.
I remember just seeing cards that were worth dollars go up to tens of dollars, which it's kind of like the penny stocks of the collectible world.
Robertson says that was great for anyone like him, who already owned lots of cards, but not for anyone who wanted to build up a deck to, you know, actually play the game.
You don't want every card you need for a 60-card deck costing tens of dollars because people don't have $500 to $1,000 to just throw at a deck, right? That's kind of crazy.
Then, last year, Hasbro, the company that makes Magic cards, released more cards than usual. Later that year, a report from Bank of America accused Hasbro of overproducing cards and diluting their value on the secondary market. Robertson says he noticed.
The cards that I bought mid to late pandemic have all come down in value.
Hasbro didn't comment for this story, but the company has denied overprinting cards. It says it simply prints enough to meet demand. Robertson says he's no longer buying those extra boxes of cards as an investment.
I've started to question that purchase because I know that that box is most likely not going to appreciate in value, and if anything, just decline the second I buy it.
The pandemic also created some opportunities for people to pile in to other types of investments.
If you're interested in artwork, it's the time to buy right now.
That's Mike Krause, an artist in Rochester, New York, who's been investing in art for around 25 years. He says galleries and art fairs basically shut down when the pandemic started, and many have struggled ever since. And that's meant that a lot of art just isn't selling.
There's kind of like a glut of artwork to be had. I've been able to buy some pieces at very reasonable rates.
We're talking hundreds of dollars here, not thousands. Krause says he's bought anywhere between 1 and 200 pieces over the last couple years. Drawings, paintings, even jewelry and clothing. Krause says some of them will probably appreciate in value, but not all of them, and he's okay with that.
If you group them up, build up kind of a collection, it's almost more like a mutual fund in that way. Like, you kind of spread the risk over all of the pieces in a way.
But unlike a mutual fund, this is art we're talking about. Krause has to find a place to store it. But he says that's a feature, not a bug.
I mean, that's the best part about it is I'm not looking at a ticker number or anything like that. It's on my wall. I get to see it. Other people get to enjoy it.
Krause says he plans on holding on to most of his art for at least 10 years. If he doesn't sell it, he says it'll be a nice nest egg to pass on. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, a coda of sorts to Sabri's story on housing starts. Saw this in the New York Times, data on federal low-income housing assistance renters, to be specific. The Times reports that the three main federal programs, public housing, Section 8, and what are called housing choice vouchers, serve about 6% fewer households now than they did at their peak, which was, not for nothing, back in 2004. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.